From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a solo concert by composer, pianist, and master of the put-on, Joel Forrester. He's also the co-founder of the Microscopic Septet. Also today, political painting. Has it lost its function? Leon Golub painted a series about torturers and mercenaries. Gerald Maserati is the author of a book about Golub and his importance as a political painter. They'll both join us. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new cop thriller, Q&A. And world music critic Milo Miles profiles Cameroonian saxophonist and bandleader Manu Dibango. Back in the early 70s, he had the only Afropop hit to ever make it onto the American pop charts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush met this afternoon with Lithuanian Prime Minister Kazimiera Prunskiene amid growing congressional opposition to administration policy toward the breakaway republic. As NPR's Anne Garrels reports, President Bush supported Lithuania's right to self-determination, but he's still unwilling to take any action against Moscow.
It was the first time the president had met a Lithuanian official since the republic declared its independence last month. In the tightrope diplomacy that's characterized his policy, President Bush called Prunskiene prime minister, but officials insist this was a private visit that does not signal a recognition of an independent Lithuanian nation. In meetings on Capitol Hill and then at the White House, Prunskiene asked for formal recognition, arguing that Gorbachev's reforms would be strengthened by this. She told the president the United States is wrong to think it must choose between Gorbachev and Lithuania. Mr. Bush told reporters earlier today he was not making that choice, that he supported both. But at this point, the president seems to be putting more emphasis on the survival of Perestroika and its architect. I'm Anne Garrels at the White House.
At its opening session today, the Soviet Republic of Latvia's newly elected parliament took a step toward independence by overwhelmingly electing Anatoly Gorbunov. Gorbunov got 153 out of 196 possible votes after a candidacy speech in which he called for new relations on new principles between Latvia and the Kremlin. Benjamin Rowe reports from Riga, Latvia.
Gorbunov said unilateral declarations and decisions win us nothing, ruling out neighboring Lithuania's route as a model for independence from Moscow. Gorbunov called instead for a pragmatic approach, saying the world, because of 5 million Balts, is not going to risk what's been achieved in arms control and what's been achieved by Mikhail Gorbachev. But Gorbunov left no doubt that the parliament, now controlled by the Latvian Popular Front, would move to restore its sovereignty. Immediately after the vote, Lithuanian President Vytautas Landsbergis congratulated Gorbunov, but he cautioned that Latvia's slower path to independence would be more difficult. The parliament also received a congratulatory telegram from Czechoslovak President Václav Havel. The lawmakers are expected to take an independence vote shortly after convening tomorrow morning. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Riga, Latvia.
The Soviet Republic of Armenia has voted to suspend the spring draft of young men into the Soviet armed forces. Following the example of Lithuania, the Armenian parliament voted to suspend the draft until there are guarantees of the safety of Armenian draftees. Like the Lithuanians, young Armenians have complained of discrimination and mistreatment in the Soviet armed forces. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed slightly higher after backing off from a substantial gain earlier in the day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 7 points to close at 2,696.17. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News. 20 people were injured today when an Amtrak train hit a log truck at a railway crossing in rural Durant, Mississippi. Amtrak officials say 16 passengers and 3 crew members were treated for minor injuries at a local hospital and released. The truck driver was reported in serious condition after being flown by helicopter to a hospital in Jackson City. Amtrak officials say the train, carrying about 200 passengers from Chicago and Kansas City, was on its way to New Orleans when the accident occurred. It's the third accident involving Amtrak in the past 10 days. The other accidents were derailments in Indiana and Iowa. The Senate Ethics Committee announced today that it has scheduled 2 weeks of public hearings in the case of Senator Dave Durenberger, Republican of Minnesota. Durenberger is accused of violating Senate rules and federal election laws. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The committee is conducting a formal investigation into whether Durenberger violated Senate rules regarding outside income when he entered into a $100,000 book deal with Piranha Press of Minneapolis. The committee is also looking into Durenberger's failure to disclose reimbursements for travel expenses in connection with appearances to promote the two books he wrote for Piranha. Durenberger's is the first case in the Senate to reach the state of a full investigation, complete with public hearings, since Harrison Williams was investigated by his colleagues for his involvement in the Abscam scandal 9 years ago. Once the hearings are finished, the Ethics Committee will decide whether or not to recommend disciplinary action to the full Senate. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Two more policemen were shot to death today in the Colombian cocaine center of Medellin. Police in the city say the murders brought to 38 the number of police killed since the beginning of April, when Colombia's drug traffickers renewed their war on the government. Authorities also say that 9 people were wounded in a hand grenade attack in the northern part of the country. 5 children and 4 adults were wounded by shrapnel when unknown attackers threw a hand grenade. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joel Forrester, and he's the composer and pianist behind such Fresh Air favorites as Lobster in the Limelight. Here's another one of Joel's, Off Color. These are two of the records that we play the most on Fresh Air. They both feature the microscopic septet. Joel is the group's pianist and co-founder and writes a lot of the group's music. But like most of the members of the Micros, he plays in several other groups as well. And lately he's been doing a lot of solo work at New York clubs. Although I've managed to see the Micros several times in the past year, my trips to New York have never coincided with Joel's solo dates. So I invited him to perform at the piano in Fresh Air's Philadelphia studio so we all could listen. Joel Forrester, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, gee, Terry. Let me just say from the jump that it's a gas to play live here on Fresh Air.
Why don't you get us started with a tune?
Well, yes, I'd like to start with a tune called Stop the Music.
Great. That's Joel Forrester at the piano. Joel, I've heard you play with the Micros and heard your records and stuff, and I think a lot of your playing and composing, you know, really combines elements of early jazz and elements of the avant-garde. How did you start doing that? How did those two come together for you?
Well, I think they just sort of appeared before my ears. But so many different kinds of music have meant the world to me, mm-hmm. that eventually that became the world, I would say. And I didn't think I could scant one, you know, and emphasize another. Just so many different forms of jazz just seemed to have announced themselves to me to be ready, to be played. I couldn't imagine really playing without boogie-woogie, playing without bebop, playing without New Orleans music from the turn of the century.
Was it hard for you to find people to play with?
Eventually, in New York, people came around. But I think that the unifying factor among us was love for Thelonious Monk and the whole weird tradition in jazz.
The weird tradition in
jazz. That's right. We found that wherever we were coming from, the lightning rod of Monk's music allowed us to have a suspicion that we might be able to make music together.
Can you play something for us that will give us a sense of the weird strain? Is that the way you put it?
Oh, I guess I can try. Actually, to tell you the truth, this tune has a it's really encumbered with history.
Uh-huh.
It's a tune called Dr. Real. Dr. Real is the name of a character in a novel I wrote about 20 years ago called The Real Life of Richard Nixon. He tempted Nixon to a sort of Faustian bargain. Dr. Real was a name that I assumed when I got out of the clink for draft resistance, when I wanted to play, and I wanted to play under an assumed name. And many of those gigs were gigs playing behind silent film. And I did that in San Francisco for a fat year under the name Dr. Real. And this is the tune that came out of that experience. Thank you.
wonderful. That's Joel Forrester at the piano. It's wonderful the way you create this really infectious rhythm and then occasionally completely subvert it.
I have no choice in the matter, Terry. Something else, something overwhelming occurs, and I have to go with it if I want to stay in the groove.
When you came up with the name Dr. Real, it was after you were a draft resister, spent
some time
in prison. What was it like to be in prison and not have a piano to play? How long were you in prison?
Oh, just a few months. It wasn't long. I drew a 3-year sentence. Everyone gets out quite early.
Mm-hmm.
There was a piano, but it was reserved for Sunday church services. And I remember it being played in a very four-square, rhomboid fashion by a member of the Gideon Bible Society, who was sort of on loan serving the lumpen, you know, déclassé. And I petitioned the warden time out of mind, you know, to allow me to play, and he always copped to the liberal democratic riff that if I were allowed to play, then all the prisoners would be allowed to play piano. And can't you picture it, Terry, these thousands of pianists lining up to take each his one moment at the keys.
You were telling me that when you were around 15 and started playing your first gig.
That's right.
That you lied to your parents about who you were playing with.
My mother, who's listening to this in Pittsburgh the day after my birthday, Mother, I'm sorry. Yes, I did lie to you when I was 15. I told you that those guys with whom I was playing at the Panther Room, you know, by the Liberty Tubes, I said they were college men. They weren't, Mother. They were just these rummies from around Pittsburgh who were probably still doing gigs at the Panther Room today.
What influence did they have on you?
Oh, I think they brought out and tempered my latent sarcasm. They were the first people, Terry, I'd ever heard use words for meanings that weren't apparent. For example, this guitar player, Ron McClure, I recall from those days, used to say beautiful man when he meant its opposite, and that had a deep impression, made a very deep impression on my head.
Think it affected the way you ended up talking?
Yes, I think so. I mean, certainly my way of thinking is very ripe by this point, and I think that I was started on that slippery slope by those guys around Pittsburgh.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and
then we'll
come back for some more music with Joel Forrester. Joel Forrester is a pianist, composer, and co-founder of the group The Microscopic Septet. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're back with Joel Forrester at the piano. Joel, you wanted to play another piece for us.
Okay,
what's that piece called?
It's called Lunacy, Terry.
When did you write it?
That's in that post-jail time, San Francisco, 71, I guess.
What mm-hmm. were you going through musically at the time, or
God
emotionally?
God knows. You know, I mean, I think R. Crumb was correct when he said that if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. I have no idea what I was going through.
Okay, that's a terrific piece. I really love it.
Well, you know, I usually improvise on it, too, but you wanted the short version.
That's right,
you know?
Yeah. All right. Okay. Some of the work you're doing in New York now has to do with trying to revitalize the musicians' union and make it relevant to jazz musicians. I think it's fair to say that in New York, the musicians' union has mostly been for people in theatrical settings.
Yes, that's right.
And also for catered affairs. You know, where you're playing with a pickup band or something, and there's, you know, the musician kind of regulates what the union regulates what the standard fee is going to be for weddings and bar mitzvahs and things like that.
Yes, that's right, Terry. Luckily for those of us who spend most of our time improvising music, just in the last few years, there have been a couple ears in the musicians' union, ears that have appreciated our kind of music and understand the importance of keeping it alive. In fact, the current administration in the city of New York has been sympathetic to musicians who play real music in clubs.
What's an example of how you can make the musicians' union more relevant to jazz musicians?
Well, the example that springs into my mind is has to do with a club that fired its entire group of musicians several years ago because they attempted to bargain collectively. We found out through the musicians' union this was actually illegal by state labor standards. And using the legal force of the union, really as advisors, we decided not to recognize the firing since it was illegal. And we had a job action that we actually called a strike. It only lasted 3 weeks, and the club succumbed because they weren't used to dealing with people collectively. And we succeeded in getting a real contract. That's important because, again, this is something that people not in New York should know. The club scene is difficult in New York only because the club owners really have the upper hand. Anything that what's good about the club scene in New York is that there's no one kind of music there. And so oddballs like myself can play there because club owners don't have a clue about what music is standard or normative or popular. That's good. But as individuals, club owners can really lord it over musicians. That's why I think it's important that musicians stand together. And that also reflects, I think, a greater thing that's happening, which is just more openness among jazz musicians, less competition, an attempt to share information about gigs. And I think what's really behind that is more musical, I think, even than labor-oriented. I think musicians want our music to change, and we're all interested in a sort of a repollination of the music. We want it to keep going. We want it to turn into whatever it's going to turn into next. And so we're sharing a lot of information, musical information.
We are unfortunately running out of time. Let me ask you to play something to close us out.
Oh, God, I'd love to. Actually, what I have in mind to play is a tune that I wrote for one of my fellow two-fisted pianists, Joe Ruddock. Pictures him, if you will, as a matador, and it's called In the Ring. Thank you.
Joel Forrester has been playing for us. And Joel, do you have any solo records you plan on making?
Oh, plans. I guess eventually.
Goals, Joel. What are your goals?
It's all in the moment, Terry. No, I just want to keep on writing music. I think maybe this summer I'll be playing solo at the Montreal Jazz Festival, though.
Great. Well, I thank you so much. It's really been just wonderful to hear you play. Thanks so much for coming to Fresh Air.
Oh, it's been wonderful to be here.
Joel Forrester is pianist, composer, co-founder of the Microscopic Septet, and they do have several records out. Joel, can you play us out?
I'd love to.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Moral monsters. That's how one critic described the torturers and mercenaries in Leon Golub's paintings. Coming up, we meet Golub and Gerald Maserati, the author of a book about Golub and political painting. Also, world music critic Milo Miles profiles Manu Dibango. Despite the current Afropop craze, Dibango's Sol Makossa is still the only African record by an African to reach the top 40 in America, and that was nearly 20 years ago. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Q&A, starring Nick Nolte and Timothy Hutton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush said today that the U.S. is preparing to make a gesture of goodwill toward Iran for its role in freeing the American hostages. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president said he did not want to make any gesture that might be perceived as negotiating for the release of the remaining American hostages. However, there is a case involving four Iranian diplomats in which the U.S. might be helpful to Iran.
Now, if there's some way that we can go back and get any information that would relieve the anxieties of their loved ones, of those four people, we ought to do that.
The four Iranian diplomats were kidnapped in Beirut in July 1982 and were never heard from again. No one took credit for their abduction. The president said the best information the U.S. has is that the diplomats are dead. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A top NATO expert on Soviet affairs says that there's heavy pressure on Soviet leader Gorbachev from the Soviet military, but that reports the country is on the edge of a civil war are simply not true. Christopher Donnelly says the Soviet military may have staged a show of force in recent months, and there are signs that it's been given a greater say-so in matters. Earlier, unnamed NATO officials had been quoted as saying that the Soviet Union came close to civil war earlier this year, when troops were said to have massed in a Moscow suburb and handed out weapons. A long-sought-after Nazi criminal arrived in Germany from Argentina today after a 17-year-long extradition process. Deidre Berger has more.
Joseph Schwamberger was handed over to German authorities today in Stuttgart, where he will stand trial for Nazi war crimes. The 78-year-old is charged with murdering up to 1,000 people and helping to deport thousands of Jews to concentration camps from 1942 to 1944. For nearly 40 years, Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal tried to track down Schwamberger, who escaped from Europe to Argentina shortly after the war. Schwamberger lived in Argentina openly for decades, only going underground after West Germany asked for his extradition in 1973. Argentinian authorities finally arrested him in November of 1987. The extradition only came about after lengthy court proceedings in Argentina. Schwamberger's trial could prove to be the last important Nazi trial in Germany. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Over 20 people were injured this morning when an Amtrak passenger train hit a truck in Durant, Mississippi. It was the second Amtrak crash in 2 days. In the latest accident, the driver of the truck was trapped in the wreckage over 2 hours. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 6.5 points to close at 2,696.17. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In 1973, years before the current Afropop craze, the record Sol Makossa became an international hit, and Mano Dibango of Cameroon became the world's most famous Afropop performer. Even though the saxophonist and bandleader isn't as celebrated anymore, world music critic Milo Miles says he's still very active and full of surprises.
I don't know if he'd approve or not, but I always want to call him Uncle Dibango. I feel that affectionate toward the sax man with the shaved head and the mirror shades. While he's only 56, Manu Dibango is one of the true veterans of modern African pop. It took him a long time to work out the eclectic music that would put him in the spotlight, but when he did work it out, the whole world heard it. This was back in the dim mists of time, back in 1973, when it still seemed that everyone's pants were bigger at the bottom than at the top. Yes, the chant Michael Jackson stuck at the end of Wanna Be Startin' Something was taken from Sol Makossa. Dibango originally recorded Sol Makossa in 1971 as a kind of afterthought, an instrumental used to fill up the B-side of a single. A New York DJ named Frankie Crocker began playing it a couple of years later, and it took off like the proverbial shot. Sol Makossa remains the only African record by an African to reach the top 40. What's so special about it? Well, it has a concision, a sort of pop-tuned punch that many African dance numbers ignore, and the hook and the rhythm are wound together perfectly. But I've always thought the real secret was that Dibango had studied the big, honking tenor sax players on American soul records, particularly King Curtis. He could have called the number Cameroon Soul Stew. However, by the time he recorded Sol Makossa, Dibango was living in Paris, and his far-flung travels help explain the fascinating variety of his music. Dibango has played in a lot of different scenes. He was trained as a classical pianist in Paris, but he spent the last half of the 50s playing jazz in Europe. Then he returned to Africa and played with a major rumba band in Zaire. Then he returned to Europe, where he jammed with visiting American soul performers and led the house band on a French TV show. As you can tell, DeBango's a restless guy, always pushing something new into Afropop, always trying to stretch the boundaries of what he plays. His eager experimental attitude has been as much an inspiration to African performers as his music. He's a permanent avant-gardian. Until now, there's always been a good DeBango and a bad DeBango. The good DeBango charged through up-tempo jams and exploratory rhythm workouts. The bad DeBango crept through sluggish reggae ditties and light jazz tunes with shallow improvisation so mellow that he seemed about to turn into Kenny G or something equally disastrous. Lo and behold, DeBango has a new import album called Negropolitanes that gets back to his roots in 60s Afropop, and it's his best easygoing record ever. It features sensuous, flowing covers of Miriam Makeba, the eminent bandleader Dr. Nico, and this old favorite from DeBango's Zaire days, Joseph Kali's Independence Cha-Cha. Of course, DeBango properly considers himself one of the old masters, and the record includes a host of his sly originals. With the recent explosion of new, younger talents in Afropop, it would be easy to assume Manu DeBango is old hat, washed up. Negropolitans proves just how wrong that would be.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. Manu DeBango's Negropolitans is on the Soul Paris label. This is Fresh Air. Political painting, what meaning does it have in a culture like ours, where people get their visual stimulation from TV, movies, and photographs, and art has become a chic form of investment? Leon Golub is a political artist who started to get a lot of attention in the 80s for his series of paintings of mercenaries and torturers, subjects one critic described as moral monsters. In Golub's 1981 painting, Interrogation, a naked man is hanging upside down. One interrogator is asking a question, while another holds a club ready to beat the prisoner. Gerald Maserati has just written a book about Golub's art. The book also considers the relevance of painting in today's world. It's called A Painter of Darkness. Leon Golub and Gerald Maserati are both with us. The first time Maserati saw one of Golub's shows, there was a warning on the gallery door. It said, "Please be advised that the current exhibition may be inappropriate for viewing by children." Maserati thought that was pathetic.
My immediate reaction was, "My God, this has been there's been so much that's gone on in modern art and modern painting in the last 75 to 100 years that the idea that any thing that you could see in an art gallery would actually shock a child who's exposed to all kinds of violence on television or in movies, seemed to me, I took it as a kind of provocation, like a sort of a piece of theater, which turned out not to be true.
When did you decide that you were wrong?
About 15 seconds after I got in the gallery. And it just was sort of shocked by the paintings.
Leon Golub, how did you start your series of paintings of torturers and mercenaries?
The reason I went into the mercenaries was I was interested in, and I have been interested in, I was then, and I continue to be interested in, the subject of power, political power, and how a nation or how individuals within a nation visualize the extensions of these of power. And very simply put, I felt I could portray it better through mercenaries than through regular soldiers, because the mercenaries are at the peripheries. You see, they're at the edges. They're at the point where one thing shifts into something else, where overt action shifts into covert action, where some of our secret motives are brought out into the open more or less.
And I guess it's because you're interested in power that in torture, for instance, you're focusing on the perpetrators, not on the victims.
Well, I'm actually focusing on both, but the victims don't have much choice. In other words, the victim plays the part of victim, and generally the way you can characterize them is through terror, fear, you know. Victimage is a relatively passive, or maybe very passive, state. The person who is active is the sadist, the torturer, the person who has the choices in that situation. If you want to portray who they are, then you want to get into their complex motives. One doesn't have to get into the complex motives of the victim.
Now, the torturers and mercenaries that you paint, they're not generic people. I mean, these are individuals, and you really get their individuality quite well. Who are the people posing for you?
Well,
I'm making an assumption here that you're using models of some sort or another.
I use photographs. I have a
of few, who?
Well, fishermen, boys and girls in love.
Well, I'll tell
anything.
You, if I was a fisherman and I walked into a museum one day and saw that I was the one, you know, torturing someone with a bag over their head, I'd feel less than great about it.
It's changed. They're changed. In other words, I try to get certain more or less typical but individualized gestures. And I project myself into this, which is what artists and writers have always done. You project yourself into a situation and visualize it. And then you, in a sense, inhabit it, and yet you're distanced from it at the same time. In other words, my job is to somehow sense what these people are like. Now, it's not that difficult for me to do that if I start on the assumption, which I do, that these people are like you and I. They're not really any different.
Jerry Maserati, let me ask you. You say that you think most of the time political art doesn't work. Why
That's
not?
Right. I've never been particularly attracted to protest art. I think that what Leon is doing is different. I think he's making a kind of contemporary history painting. He's got a certain detachment from the events themselves. Someone who is making a poster to protest American military aid to El Salvador would not want to make an image that was in some ways as ambiguous and complex and ultimately as ambivalent as Leon's images are. If I wanted to end American military aid to El Salvador, I would certainly focus, say, on the victims. I might use certain types of language as well as pictorial elements. I wouldn't want to have images of torturers that seemed in some ways humanly complicated.
Leon Golub, how do you see the function of your political art? Do you want to change minds with it or affect people on an emotional level?
Oh, sure. But that's a kind of big program, you know? I would say that artists are part of the consciousness industry. In other words, there's stuff going on out there. There are events going on out there. And somehow we're involved with it. And I want to, in a way, put in my own claim for what is happening today and make a report on the contemporary world. I think of art as, in a sense, a report on the state of civilization at any given time, okay? And I am trying to bring in something which I think has been at least partially, if not more than partially, left out, that art has been a relatively protected enclave in let's say, the 20th century. And it's left out our political world, and I think it's a huge gap.
Leon Golub, there are times when realism seems to go out of favor, let alone political art. Were there times in your life when you felt that it was difficult to get your political art shown? In other words, times when you thought that the subject matter of your art was getting in the way of reaching an audience or getting a gallery?
Yes, of course. Political art is not attractive in a commodity-oriented art world. In other words, there aren't too many stockbrokers who want to come home at the end of a day, it's been a long day, and think they're crashing in Wall Street, for example, or something else, or think they're going well, so on, want to come home and have a drink before a 10-foot painting of mine of such subject matter, you see. It's much more pleasant to have this drink in front of other kinds of work, or even a blank wall. So you have to find those arenas, those individuals, and they certainly do exist, who, for whatever reasons, are willing to view this work and accept it.
You know, one of the questions Jerry Maserati raises in his book about you, Leon Golub, is what does it mean when, you know, paintings of torturers and mercenaries end up selling to somebody like Charles Saatchi, who's a very, very wealthy art collector, and a lot of people say that he sets the trends of who the next hot artist is going to be, because if he's investing in that artist's sales are going to really go up, and the prices that they get are going to go up. But Saatchi runs a really big advertising company in England, and he's done campaigns for P.W. Botha, for Margaret Thatcher. So when someone whose politics are so different in a way from the kinds of politics that your paintings are about, how does it make you feel? Do you care who buys your work?
I care and I don't care. In an ideal world, maybe only certain individuals would be buying the work. Who knows? But it's not an ideal world, and I don't know that Saatchi is any worse or necessarily better than, let's say, the trustees of a museum, you know, in a major city in the United States or elsewhere, who would buy my work. In other words, I am not capable, nor am I interested in putting a means test on these individuals, because if I do it to one person, I'm going to have to do it to others.
Jerry Maserati, I wonder if this question gives you problems as a writer, so as someone who writes about art but doesn't paint or sculpt.
Well, you know, I can be ambivalent about the market for art. I think that it in the 1980s, the market became so fevered that it tended to become a kind of discourse in itself, and for people who were writing about art, it pushed us to the margins. It sort of was its own conversation about art. And that was a problem. But the fact is, I'm ultimately much more comfortable with a market for paintings, that is, paintings sold in galleries to collectors who ultimately get them before the in front of the public one way or another, than I am with artists living on government grants or something like that. Ultimately, Charles Saatchi gets this work of Leon's before the in front of the public. I'm much more comfortable with that than if it was all done by the government, and you know, these are precisely the paintings that no government would be anywhere would be comfortable with. So the market, in its own sort of lurching and troubling way, works. It works. I can't think of any other better system.
Well, I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you,
thank you.
Writer Gerald Maserati and painter Leon Golub. Maserati's new book on Golub is called A Painter of Darkness, Leon Golub and Our Times. It's published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We are leading the show today with the president's decision to take short-range nuclear missiles out of Europe, and we'll be talking about what will replace them, how we've defended Europe in the past, and what we will do next.
But the big story is it's All Things Considered's 19th birthday.
That's right. 19 years ago today, this program went on the air, and we're celebrating by listening to the All Things Considered theme through the ages. This is a theme that appears in lots of different places, in symphonies, in songs, in movies. It was in Jaws, Terry. You probably didn't know that.
Oh, but I did. Okay, well, that and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Sidney Lumet lives in New York City, and he set several of his movies there, Prince of the City, Serpico. His new movie, Q&A, gets into corruption and racism in New York. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Q&A is Sidney Lumet's smartest, most entertaining picture in years, and his first movie since the glory days of Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon to prove as provocative as he intends it to be. That's because he's tackling two subjects here, and they play off each other like spices. One is Lumet's old favorite, New York police corruption. But the other is something new. It's the racism that has crept above ground during the 80s, infecting nearly every facet of New York life. For Lumet, the city's judicial apparatus becomes a microcosm for the great melting pot that just won't melt. In the precinct houses, in the DA's offices, it's the Irish versus the Jews, versus the blacks, versus the Puerto Ricans. On the Irish side, we meet the veteran homicide detective Mike Brennan, played by Nick Nolte, who's just killed a Puerto Rican informer and tried to make it look like self-defense. The assistant DA, played by Patrick O'Neill, is Irish too, and he wants Mike's indiscretion covered up, so he calls in the greenest young Irish lawyer on his staff, Al Riley, played by Timothy Hutton, to handle the interrogation, the Q&A, that'll go to the grand jury. Mike looks innocent until Al starts digging, and soon Lumet has laid out a vast network of corruptions based on pitting one ethnic group against another inside the system. Nolte's Mike Brennan figures he can get Hutton's Al Riley off the case if he just talks to him in his usual half-friendly, half-menacing way. After all, nobody's completely clean. Al himself used to be a cop, and his partner Moon was corrupt, and Al didn't say anything about it then, did he?
Like you rode with Moon Mullins, right?
Yeah.
Well, he's retired now, right? He's in Miami. It's Moon over Miami, huh? But let's say some eager beaver assistant DA gets a hold of me. Hey, we know you were taken. We got your nuts in our hand. We know who you rode with. He didn't report it, so he must have had his hand in too, right, Moon?
Cops don't rap that easy, Mike.
Oh, I know that, Al. But you got to picture Moon. I mean, for Christ's sake, his pension for good could go. In the meantime, his DA's crooning in his ear, give us some names, we'll give you immunity, give us cops. You think Moon's going to sit on that? He'll give him the whole PBA roster.
Nolte is an extraordinary monster in this movie. A terrifying hound dog of a villain, whose bark is plenty scary and whose bite is even worse. But actors love Sidney Lumet because he encourages them to froth and twitch and eat the decor. And that's what a lot of his players do here. Patrick O'Neill and Timothy Hutton are so excruciatingly typecast that everything they do seems ponderous and predictable. And the movie is full of thugs straining to seem thuggish and transvestites straining to seem queenie. Meanwhile, the director's daughter, Jenny Lumet, strains to seem merely competent in the misconceived role of Hutton's ex-fiancée. She spends most of the movie blaming Hutton for everything that's gone wrong in her life, just because he had a funny look on his face when he found out her father was black. She also says she once fell out of love with a man when he came to bed with just his socks on. Touchy, touchy. It's bad ideas like these that cast shadows on Lumet's good ones. Meanwhile, his movie steams and swirls. His actors struggle to out-ham each other. The racial slurs fly and the plot twists coil, and Q&A gradually begins to seem almost hilariously overwrought. Lumet has made his best film in years, but I still left it feeling as though someone had spent the last 2 hours sitting on my head and screaming in my ear.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Lou Jean DeJoseph. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross. ¶¶
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Hubert Selby Jr., his controversial 1964 novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn, about hoods, addicts, and prostitutes, has just been made into a film. Also, we meet one of Ireland's leading novelists, John Banville. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.